Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Mary Spio. Mary, so glad you could join us.
Thank you. Thank you. Super excited to be here.
Well, Mary, I was personally very excited to have you on because I read your bio and what it is you do, and pretty much you're an exact fit for our demographic. They're the type of people who will make sure the family pets go without food to buy your service, I think.
Well, probably
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a fascinating bio that you have. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us kind of the 30,000-foot view of who Mary Spio is.
So very top level. I started out as a deep space scientist. So building satellites, launching rockets, doing all that, you know, fun space stuff. But I've always been interested in distribution technology, you know, more interested in entertainment technology. So I kind of drifted to what a lot of engineers call the dark side, which is focusing on, you know, applications rather than building, you know, very high tech. So I went to work for the Boeing company. I was researching a lot of technologies on distributing content, you know, particularly very high data rate content, movies. And they were also looking for a way to do that for clients like Lucasfilms, Fox, 20th Century Fox, et cetera. And so they bought some of my technology. I went to work for Boeing as a head of satellite communications. And, you know, we built digital cinema to distribute, you know, movies over satellite. And then after that, I've just really been focused on content distribution over internet, because even though we created a tremendous cost savings for distributing movies over satellite, which is the industry standard today, it still wasn't affordable for a lot of independents. So my next focus was on helping independents distribute their movies over the internet. And then it's just evolved. The content distribution has evolved to mobile, and now, you know, I'm focused on virtual reality.
So I just realized something. I just asked her for the 30,000-foot view, and she's dealing with space stuff. Like, it should have been, like, what, yeah, like the 200,000?
3-mile view or something.
Well, yeah. 3-mile. Yeah. That's only 15,000 feet.
3 miles is only 15,000.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like 5,000 foot a mile. So that would have been shallower. I should have said, like, what, the 200,000-foot view or something. I mean, don't satellite
right, the
float
2884.
Around. Yeah, see,
I already 2884K view, yeah, from the galaxy or something,
yeah,
view.
I already screwed it up.
I've never understood that
I haven't
phrase
either.
Anyway, because you can't see crap from 30,000 feet.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I was always told to say. Mm. But anyway, sorry.
So Mary, tell us about Seek.
So Seek is we're a distribution platform for virtual worlds, right? So now everybody's, you know, 5 years ago when I was talking about the metaverse, everybody was looking at me like, okay, what is the metaverse? Which now with Zuckerberg talking about it, with, you know, Vitalik and everyone talking about the metaverse, which basically is Web 3.0. So it's just these interconnected worlds. And that's basically what Seek is. We help content creators, particularly, you know, now we're working with a lot of sports teams. We're working with, music artists to be able to build their virtual worlds and also distribute content through their virtual worlds in this metaverse. And then ultimately, it's just going to be available for everyone to create their own virtual world, which can parallel, you know, the physical world, or can be something completely magical, which is what a lot of people want to do. They don't just want to take their current world and recreate it, you know, but that's basically what we do, is we're creating a mechanism for any and everyone to be able to create an alternate universe for themselves.
So very like Ready Player One kind of atmosphere, right? I think that was a lot of people's first kind of delve into what that would be, or maybe Matrix a little bit, but more Ready Player One, because everybody kind of knew that they were going into the fake world or the metaverse or whatever. So what do you think of Ready Player One? I mean, are we going to get there with kind of this technology?
That's exactly it. We're going to get there with it, you know, and working with Brett Leonard also is like Lawnmower Man, right? Where he puts on the VR headset and then he's in this alternate metaverse. But it is exactly that. It's Ready Player One. It's, you know, Lawnmower Man. It's, you know, that's exactly it. And I think that during the pandemic also, a lot of people wanted to find a way to travel without leaving the comfort of their home, whether by default or, you know, by some kind of mandate. And we even saw a lot of frontline workers too that were just unplugging by just putting on our VR headset and going into Mind Chill and just chilling, you know, for even if it's like 30 minutes or 10 minutes, they just want to be in a different world and then come back. And now we're seeing a lot of crypto enthusiasts that are putting they're storing their NFTs and their artwork, because storing it in a wallet is so boring. But imagine now you could put your artwork in your, you know, alternate universe. You could put it in your new world.
So glad you brought up NFTs. So with the Wolf and I, we've been talking about NFTs and we don't really understand it. We don't have a clue. So can you explain to people what NFTs are and how they work and why they're important?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically an NFT or non-fungible token, I don't know who came up with, you know, the expression, but it's a digital collection. So the same way that you collect a piece of art, but the difference is that with this digital collection, it's recorded on the blockchain, and the blockchain is an interconnected world of all these independent people. So it's not, you know, centralized. It's not like, say, you know, YouTube saying that, oh, you had 3 views, or, you know, this video was uploaded and this many people have seen it. It's just a whole bunch of independent people that are validating any and every information that you put about a specific piece of content or a specific item. And so with the NFTs, if you create a piece of digital art, like the Wolf and the Shepherd banner that you have in the back there, you could take a picture of it, sign it, scan it, and say, I'm only selling 1 copy of that, and put it on the blockchain. And we will be able to, you know, you will have an address for it. So whoever acquires that picture with your autograph and that wallet would be the only person in the world with it. And because it's attached to that particular wallet, if somebody else shows up and says, hey, I have a copy of this, as soon as, you know, you go online, you won't be able to validate that this is the only one because it's attached to that particular wallet. So it's just really people collecting digital art. And I think that the excitement about it is because you're able to validate the authenticity of where it originates.
Is that anything similar to like an original piece of art by an artist versus a print? Because somebody explained it to me that way. It's like, you know, you got the Mona Lisa, right? And the Mona Lisa is over in the Louvre in Paris. But you can buy a print of the Mona Lisa. And everybody, of course, because it's a very famous painting, knows that you don't have the real one. But you can buy these, like, limited edition runs of a print. And so they're worth something. Or you can just go and buy a poster and put it in there. And it's worth whatever you paid for, probably 50% less than that once you leave the store. Kind of the same thing, or am I off base?
No, that's exactly it. It's exactly it. So imagine, you know, with the Mona Lisa, because even with the Mona Lisa, we have to rely on, you know, a bunch of people to believe that this is actually it. There's really no way to verify unless we could see a video of the artist painting it. But with an NFT, you have the immutable ledger that says this is the only version of the Mona Lisa that exists anywhere in the world. And everybody else and everything else, if it's not tied to this specific address or wallet, then we know that it's just a print. So it's buying the original. But some people are also making art where they say, well, we're only going to sell 10 copies. And especially with music, you know, with music, when we see that, when we're getting into music NFTs, there are a lot of variations that we're seeing with it, because you can make a song and you can have 10 people buy fractional pieces of that song. And so every time it gets played, all those 10 people will get paid for it.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, we have a limited knowledge of decentralized networks through cryptocurrencies. I mean, we've been collecting crypto for about 2-3 years, various coins and stuff. And so we do kind of understand, you know, the benefits of decentralization, and also understand that, you know, there's a lot of applications being built on those decentralized networks. What gives NFTs their value? Because I saw a couple of weeks ago, there were a bunch of limited edition art pieces of some like apes, some comical apes, and they were selling for like millions of dollars. But what gives them their value? Because, I mean, if I drew a unique picture now and signed it, my son would just like roll it up into a ball and throw it in the trash because it'd be a crap drawing.
So would I.
Yeah. But probably before I finished drawing, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. But what gives them this value? Because, I mean, surely if they sold the original artwork, put it in a frame and signed it, having the physical thing, you'd assume would have more value than a digital copy of something. So why are the prices for a lot of these NFTs just so high?
You know, and it's in a way, it's a huge mystery for some, right? Because you will see some truly, truly magnificent NFTs that are selling for, let's say, $100, and you don't have a bunch of people buying it. And then you see a pixelated, you know, NFT of an ape, and, you know, somebody pays, you know, $200,000 for it. So a big part of it is people building the networks. You know, some people are also very skeptical about some of these NFTs that are selling for millions and millions of dollars that don't make sense. You know, is it something nefarious going on where it's being used as a front? You know, so there are a lot of things that are going on, especially when it comes to NFTs. But most people are building, you know, an audience within the crypto community and then putting these unique artworks out. And so when they put it out, their fans want to be able to get it as a way of storing value. And so it's like a perceived value. So if they can really hype it up, you know, to where people are paying $200,000 for it, then they know that there's that stored value within it. And so their goal would be to be able to sell it again for even higher value. You know, I've seen things from Logan Paul and Francis Ngannou, and this one, you know, I think he had a NFT that sold for $580,000. It's really the perceived value of, it's the same as the Mona Lisa. I'm sure that during that time period, there were a lot of, you know, art pieces that did not get the same notoriety as the Mona Lisa. So it's just all perceived value and, you know, how much publicity and how much attention you can garner for that piece of work.
So not to continue to dwell on NFTs, but I have one final question on that one. I also read that there was a way that if artists or whatever create this NFT and then it continues to sell, you know, just like people collect art, people collect whatever, and in the normal world, the non-metaverse, right? If I sell something to the Wolf, he now owns it. And if he sells it to you, I don't get any benefit. But in the NFT world, kind of the original creator somehow gets some kind of trickle down off of this. Am I on base, off base? Am I confused on that? Is that true?
No, it's very true. That's 100%. So depending on the way the smart contract is written, a lot of times the original creator would get, let's say, 10%. So if you sold your artwork and then somebody else bought it, as the value increases, every time it sells, you get a 10% of the, you know, of the proceeds. And so that incentivizes a lot of artists then to be able to sell their work and to continue to live sustainably from their content. It's been very, I think what we're seeing now with art, before you didn't have that, but with music, it's always been that way, you know, because with almost every piece of music, it's very rare that you see an artist that has sold their catalog, you know, entirely. But usually they have a percentage, you know, and then you have the publishers that would have a percentage. So every time, no matter what happens and all the different machinations that it goes through, unless they sell that percentage interest in the particular piece of music, they will continue to benefit, you know, from the sale, from the exploitation of that music. And, you know, I'm happy to see that that's happening with art now, because no matter who, you know, you sell it to, the fact that you can continue to, you know, sustain yourself from that piece of art is just, you know, I think it's incredible.
Yeah, it's almost, if you think about like an author, right, and they write a book and that book sells and they get a royalty off that, but then it goes to half price books, right? And somebody buys that book at half price books, that author doesn't get any money off of that, but somebody is buying that book. So the NFT kind of solves that problem.
It does. It does. And I think that with crypto, we're going to see a whole lot more. People are looking at, you know, NFTs for real estate. People are looking at NFTs for furniture, I mean, for any and everything that you can think of. But really what they're looking at are smart contracts, you know, because smart contracts have just really made life so much easier. And between, you know, blockchain and smart contracts, you're seeing business transact in a whole new way, way beyond what anybody imagined, you know, with Ethereum or with, you know, even with Bitcoin.
Yeah. How do you feel that it's going to be marketed? Because, you know, we have a situation in society where, say, like if Shepherd, if either of his parents get a new phone, you start getting PTSD because it's like, oh my goodness, I've got to explain how to power on, power off, how to, you know, check a text, take a photo, send a photo. We're pretty tech savvy, but, you know, some of this NFT stuff, etc., you know, if we start talking to a stranger about that, you know, they're going to close off within about 10 seconds. How do you kind of plan to simplify, you know, explaining the whole procedure? Or do you think that's even necessary to explain the background of these new technologies and just show people the technology, say, this is it, this is what it does, and they don't really need to understand what it's layered on top of?
Yeah, you make a very good point, you know, because the mistake that I see, for example, when VR first came, everybody was so busy talking about the technology of VR and this one and that one, and people were just, you know, glazing over and saying, oh, it's too difficult, it's too complicated. Whereas what we focused on was the user experience, you know, because with this, with any technology, look at what the iPod and, you know, iTunes did for music, where, you know, my grandmother could just take an iPod and press play or type in what she's looking for, and then her song plays. And that's what, you know, good technology and innovation is supposed to do. And so for us, our focus is on making it as simple as possible. You download an app, you put your phone in a VR headset, or you don't put in a VR headset. We're making it accessible via desktop, via mobile, via iPad. And, you know, we're even talking to companies that have these light field projectors that are coming that will allow you to project your world into the real world. So if I wanted to replace my environment, I would be able to do that. But it all has to be in a user-friendly way, to where I don't have to explain what an NFT is. Somebody can just come on a platform and I can buy a t-shirt. You know, my son plays Roblox all the time, and he buys t-shirts and all the skins. He plays Fortnite too, buying the skins and so on. That's how simple it has to be. And that's what our focus on with Seek is. It has to be super, super simple. You come on the platform, you buy what you're looking for, and you don't even think about the technology that's in the background. And for those crypto fans, if you want to go buy Seek tokens, you can buy Seek tokens on an exchange. But for everybody else, you can just come into the app, and it's no different than buying V-Bucks or Robux.
Right. So if we have three people, right, and say there's a sporting event,
Spoiler alert, have three people right now.
Right, yeah, I know. Okay. She didn't count because she knows the answer.
Oh.
Right. So if you have one person who goes to the sporting event, they've got a pretty decent seat on the, you know, eight rows up from the halfway line, whatever. Then you've got another person who goes to Buffalo Wild Wings, sits at the bar, and there's a big flat screen in front of them, and they're watching the sporting event. And then there's somebody who uses Seek. What is the difference in experience, and what does Seek offer that those other two situations, you know, don't offer, even including the live experience, because you're still limited to what you see? You don't get the benefit necessarily of seeing a lot of replays. I mean, you do at Cowboys Stadium with a big screen, but, you know, that's not always available at every sporting event. What does Seek offer, which, you know, the live experience just doesn't offer?
So what we're looking at now is the ability to really have different angles. And so if I want to be able to experience it, you know, from the field line, I will be able to do that. If I want to be able to experience it, maybe from a VIP suite upstairs, I will be able to experience that. And a big part, I tell the story about like how, you know, Seek started. I actually started with a VR headphones, and then I built the platform because I'm a huge Adele fan. I went to, she had a concert at Madison Square Garden. There were only 100,000 tickets. 10 million people tried to buy those tickets. So I was like, wouldn't it be great if for the 9.9 million people that couldn't attend, we could do so in VR and have that shared experience of that energy of being at a live event, because you could see other people around you while we enjoy, you know, the same content. And nothing existed. And so I started to work on that. And that's how, you know, Seek came about. So it's not to replace real live events, because people are always going to, you know, want to go to real live events. But it's to create a way for those people who maybe the tickets are not available, maybe the tickets are too expensive, or maybe they're not available at the time, or geographically, you know, the event is not coming to them. So we meet that need, number one. And then after we meet that need, what we want to do now is make sure that they can have an experience that they couldn't ordinarily have in real life. And so if that means, you know, watching directly from the field, we can put one single chair, you know, if let's say basketball game, we can put one single chair on the floor right next to the owner, and then a million people can enjoy the game from the owner's perspective, whereas you couldn't have a million people enjoying the game from the owner's perspective. And so that's what we offer. We teamed up with Southampton, by the way, which is English Premier League. Yeah. And there's a lot that we're going to be doing behind the scenes with the coaches and all kinds of stuff.
Now,
that
do you have your own, sorry to interrupt, Mary. Do you have your own kind of camera set up there, or do you just use what they have already and then just implement that into the service? Because I know, like, you know, if you go to the typical NFL game, it's something like 68 is the average number of cameras around the field capturing every angle. And it might even be more now because of that stop motion rotation thing. Do you use the cameras they already have, or do you have to go and put special cameras to create certain effects that your service offers?
We do both. And so for some games, people can watch in 180. With other people. And then for the 360 games, we bring our own cameras. And so we bring about five cameras, and these for a big game. So these five cameras, each of them have anywhere from, you know, 12 to 16 cameras, depending on the type of camera, but it's all in a ball, which is why we can use five cameras as opposed to 68 cameras.
Right. Okay.
So it's an array of cameras.
Right.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And, yeah. You know, one thing I could see people outside of sporting events, right? Because, you know, each sporting event is unique to itself. But, you know, you bring up the concert deal, right? And it's like, well, okay, so how could a band benefit from this if it's at different, you know, venues across the country, right? I would argue that Pearl Jam actually solved that problem because they constantly release all these live recordings, and Pearl Jam fans, even though it's the same song, over and over and over again, they play it a little bit different at each venue. So bands could still actually benefit from something like this to be able to see, you know, Pearl Jam play at House of Blues in Boston versus House of Blues in Dallas. Venues a little bit different, a little bit different views, and maybe there's different versions of the songs, you know, or, you know, maybe there's a line in the song and they replace the word Dallas with the word Los Angeles or whatever. So it's not like bands would miss out on the whole touring aspect because there would still be that benefit. Now, I remember I had a friend of mine that years ago toured around with a band and would, and not toured around with them, but followed the band. That used to be a big thing, I guess, like in the 60s. Like they, people would follow bands.
I mean, like a groupie.
No, they would be in the audience, right? But they would just go to each show and they would buy the tickets and they were watching all these shows. Virtually with Seek, you could do that from the comfort of your own home. Is that kind of a goal, maybe, that you would buy like a season pass to watch a band tour?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you would buy the season pass. That's exactly it. And so with Pearl Jam, maybe, you know, they do Germany differently than they do in Miami, than they do in, you know, Spain or something like that. And people want to be able to absorb all the different versions of it. And we have, you know, content on there, like there's Bush did a performance, and I think it's Jacksonville that we have online. We have two different performances, but both of them are different experiences, you know, and so people can experience them differently from depending on the location. And ultimately, you know, it's not now, but ultimately what we want people to even be able to do is, if I'm at a live, let's say I'm at a live Bush event, and I want to be able to sell that experience to somebody else because of the location that I was in, I'm, you know, watching it, the vantage point, I will be able to do that. You know, I'll be able to sell my ticket. I got a VVVIP ticket. And then the artist will also still get a percentage of it.
And of course, that's after you've went through the experience, right? So you've seen the show, and now you turn around and you can sell that to somebody else and maybe recoup some of your money back, maybe make money off of it, right? Thinking free marketplace right here. You know, they're going to sell it for what they can get for it, right? And then that artist in turn gets a little piece of that.
Exactly. So in the virtual world, maybe I bought a $1,000 ticket, you know, to Pearl Jam. And that gives me this position, which is in center position. And then I bought that $1,000 ticket because it's a 1 year pass. At any given time, I could say, you know what, I want to sell this ticket because there's only one of them in that particular location that I'm watching the concert from. And then you could sell it. Maybe somebody pays you $2,000 for it, you know? And that's the also the excitement of NFTs and all this, you know, blockchain stuff because of the stored value. Because if you look at Roblox, for example, you know, the amount of money the kids spend, I saw, you know, one lady talked about her kids spent $1,600 on Roblox. And at the end of it, and I believe that, you know, my son bought a t-shirt and then it was $25. I'm like, we gotta return it. But it's more expensive than a real t-shirt, but you can return it. You can do absolutely nothing with it. And then as they get older, so maybe they've spent $2,000 in Roblox. As they get older and they decide to move on to something else, there's no stored value. So we're building Roblox for the real world, in the sense that there is a stored value, there's the exchange of, you know, value. And then, you know, for some people that's exciting for them.
Yeah, I think you maybe need to set up a Roblox support group, because the shepherd here is also a victim of having multiple kids who are buying Roblox like gold.
I'd have a lot of money in the bank right now if I didn't spend it all on Roblox. You know, even my kid, he's like, you know, Dad, if I get a hit at the baseball game, you know, what will you pay me and all this? I'll be like, oh, okay, well, you know, and I make the agreement. Then we total everything up and I'm like, okay, well, you know, it's $5. And well, I want $5 in Roblox. I'm like, well, I'd rather give you the money. No, I want it in this so I can buy, you know, virtual t-shirts or whatever it is. It's just, it's bizarre. Yeah. So we've talked about it, Seek, in the ever-changing atmosphere, the sporting events, the bands, the, you know, things like that, right? What about static things, like, let's say, touring the White House, or, you know, going to the Grand Canyon or whatever? Is there a look for that with Seek, or is that just going to be traditional VR and y'all aren't looking at that at all?
No, that's in there as well. You know, I mentioned the Mind Chill events, or Mind Chill experiences. These are, you know, you're in the forest and you're in this magical forest and there's music, and we're integrating Pandora and Spotify. So you can come into the environment and you could be in a totally chill environment. And it could be the Grand Canyon. And we're also opening up the ability for other content creators to be able to build these experiences and put it on the platform. So eventually, if you want travel, if I want to be in Maui, if I want to be in, you know, Dallas, right, wherever I want to be, I would be able to find that in the app and be able to go and, you know, experience that. So it's not just limited to sports and music. That's what we're starting with. But ultimately, you know, you're looking at education and you're looking at so many different things. And there is also the aspect of the stored value. So everything that, you know, when you buy the Seek tokens to spend inside of the environment, if you decide that you don't want to, you know, you want to sell your t-shirt, you're going to be able to do that. If you decide, I just want to, you know, take my tokens and do something else with it, you could do that.
Right. So obviously there are, you know, educational, military and gaming potential applications with this new technology. Mm-hmm. In the gaming space, you know, VR's always kind of failed just because it's never really been at that point where it's good enough where it's you just feel, oh, I can't wait to get home and, you know, put on the VR headset, because, you know, the graphics haven't always been able to keep up with the power of the units, and also the amount of data it uses has always been, you know, it's affected the experience greatly. Have you found a way whereby, you know, this will still provide a premium experience given the technological limitations that some people have, because some people can barely, you know, stream a TV show? What type of data are you going to need to stream like a live event in full, you know, HD and Dolby surround sound? Is everybody going to be pretty much set up and most people will be able to use this without having a serious upgrade?
And that's actually, it's a perfect question for us, right? That's actually what we're solving, because there are some people that can afford to buy a very powerful computer and, you know, Oculus headset and all of that. And for everybody else, right, the people that are watching shows on YouTube a billion times, they just want something that's fast and quick and mobile, most likely. And so for us, a big part of our focus is building the capability of all of that in the cloud. If you remember a few years back, the Samsung phones were blowing up. A big part of that were all these plugins that were just overdriving the phones, and the audio plugins that were trying to run the spatialized audio and trying to force all these things that you normally would do with a very powerful computer. So what we're doing, because our focus is the mobile audience, is doing all that in the clouds, and then also making sure that when we're streaming, we're adjusting for the user's capability. We have our own audio headphones, 360 audio headphones that help spatialize the content, for example. So your phone doesn't have to do all that grunt work and have 70% of its, you know, performance just dedicated to the audio portion of it, to the 360 audio. We also have decoders. We've worked with DTS and, you know, all kinds of different decoders that are in our technology stack itself that does all that work for you so that you don't have to do that. Even for the content that we distribute, for when we're talking to a lot of the music artists and they're like, okay, what do we have to do? What kind of audio do you have to give to us? And we're saying, just give us a, you know, multi-channel WAV file. And they're like, well, what else do we have to do? We want your workflow to be exactly the same as what you have now, because all the content is already there. And then we let our backend technology do all the processing so that the phone doesn't have to, so that the user doesn't have to, because again, it's all about accessibility. So that's what we focus on, you know, building all that stuff in the backend so you don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, that's great, because I actually just started using Xbox Live's cloud gaming experience. Mm-hmm. My laptop costs like about $220 about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's not real powerful. It has an onboard graphics card, you know, and mm-hmm. it won't run, you know, very sophisticated gaming software. I mean, it will run, you know, Windows 11, Office 2021 fine, but if I try and play even a basic game, it starts slowing down. But with the Xbox cloud gaming service, yep, you can actually play, you know, as if you're on an Xbox One or Series X actually online, and the only data it requires is just the data inputs from my controller. And I've been playing that on and off for about the last month, and it's fantastic. And so, yeah, what you were just explaining in terms of taking the grunt work so that people don't have to have an Alienware PC or like an iPhone 13 to be able to take, you know, advantage of your service. I mean, that's definitely great news, because not everybody can afford to drop, you know, $2,000 just to have, you know, this experience. But if this experience, most people can have it. I mean, certainly, I mean, you said you've got a partnership with Southampton, you know, if you had one with Manchester United, I mean, I'd be signing up before we finish this interview. I mean, you know, I mean, the Shepherd can't wait to see the Cowboys suck in fully immersed 3D and surround sound. Hey,
they're doing good this year. Yeah. They're doing good this year. You stop it with the Cowboys hate. Yeah.
Now, in terms of gaming, I mean, the immersive gaming experience, you mentioned about the forest and the music, but a lot of those games like World of Warcraft and the Elder Scrolls, you know, the adventure games, I can see a huge market for that, because a lot of the people who play those games, including myself, you know, will play for hours and hours on end, and we're always looking for the most realistic experience possible. And I can imagine, you know, being in a VR world, it's going to cause some issues in terms of addiction. You know, if you put on the headset and suddenly all of a sudden it's like 5 o'clock in the morning, what do you think it's going to do in terms of a change of culture? Because we've already, through social media and streaming, started drifting away from a lot of the social gatherings we used to have. And certainly the pandemic, I think, reprogrammed people that, yeah, it's okay to eat at home. It's okay to watch a movie at home. You don't have to go out and have that experience. Do you think this type of technology is going to create even more of a disconnect in society in terms of social things? Because, you know, to be honest, I mean, if it was crappy weather and I had the choice between watching a game, sitting at home on my headset, or going to the live event, I might just choose to sit at home and watch it on my VR headset than, you know, fighting traffic, you know, fighting crowds, putting up with the weather and all that. I mean, I can see your service is much more attractive, but what have you thought kind of maybe about the social impact it might have?
Yeah, and I think that it's going to parallel a lot of what we saw with social media. You know, I think that it will go through the same curve where in the beginning people were choosing, you know, to stay away from in real life events. But then as all these social groups start to form, people start to feel very comfortable in these different circles. So then they start to meet again, you know, where you have all these meetups. There are now more meetups. And even during the pandemic, there were more video meetups. There were people craving to go back to in real life events. So you will see that disconnect, and then people start to connect again, because when they connect inside of the virtual world, the thing that causes, you know, addiction even more, particularly with virtual reality, is the fact that the mind hasn't been able to develop the facility to tell the difference between a VR experience and a real life experience. So if you visited the Eiffel Tower in a super realistic VR headset, which today we have, you know, HTC looks amazing. Oculus, the current version, looks phenomenal. So if you visited, your mind would tell you a year later, oh, I visited the Eiffel Tower. And you can describe it in great detail, no different than a person who's actually physically visited it. So there's this false security that's going to come with these gatherings where people almost feel like they're actually there in these shared spaces. And so there'll be a period where they unplug from in real life events. But then as humans, we're creatures of, you know, socializing. And so it then it comes through back through the cycle where we now want to meet in real life. And, you know, especially with the people that we start to feel very, very comfortable with online.
So now going back to this like virtual experience, right? And so this popped in my mind. Let's say that we create something on the podcast where you could be sitting here as we're recording, right? Mm-hmm. But then we look around in our little room and we're like, well, you know, our room sucks. So we want to make it look really cool. And so we put up, you know, and this is probably antiquated technology, but like green screens or whatever, where it looks like we have this most amazing little studio or big studio or something like that. So would that allow maybe content creators to, show a much different reality, so to speak, than, you know, looking at our,
well, like,
you
know, a different tiny background on the Zoom video, because we can have a different background, and you can have actually have moving backgrounds, but you know what I mean, like a completely 3D immersive,
right? Like background. Somebody could walk around our essentially fake studio where they're like, oh my gosh, there's this bar over here, not just a little kegerator, but like a full bar, and there's like a virtual bartender over there, and blah blah blah.
Yes. I mean,
is that where we're getting at? Even maybe within this step or the next step?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, actually, we shot a movie with Brett Leonard. He's the, you know, he's a director of Lawnmower Man. We shot a movie with him called Hollywood Rooftop. And the whole thing was shot in, they shot that on a black screen, and then they replaced the environment. So it was the movie, when you see the movie, what you're seeing is something that, you know, would be the equivalent of shooting on a green screen. But with 360 and with VR, you can get super, super realistic. You could put an avatar in the back. You could put someone in the back there at the bar. You know, you can fill your room with people, and it would be, it's like filters on a whole new level.
Yeah, almost also adding like AI to that, right?
Yes.
To make the NPC, so to speak, more realistic than like Grand Theft Auto or Red Dead Redemption 2, where they only have like certain things they're going to do. You could add the AI. So,
well, that's normally because you've killed them within 30 seconds in those two examples.
No, I've got high honor in both those games. But essentially then, I could create a studio, right? And I could take recordings of the wolf's voice and then create a virtual version of him. And then he could be my co-host, and I wouldn't have to put up with him in real life anymore, is what you're saying.
You could put a hologram of him right next to you, and you wouldn't even know.
That's interesting. Hang on. I'm signing up for this right now.
Yeah, but you know I'm going to hack him.
Well, that's true.
It won't be me here. You'll have somebody 10 times more obnoxious if we can find
him. That's probably true. Yeah. You'll figure out a way to ruin this for me like you do everything else.
So, Mary, just so we can get people saving up as it's coming close to Christmas here, what kind of price point entry level, say if the Shepherd wants to go to a Dallas Cowboys game, or he wants that, you know, halfway line seat, few rows up, what would he be looking at for a basic experience?
So for a basic experience, the ticket itself varies. So it could be from $9.99 to $24. Or for a subscription, you know, you have a basic subscription of $9.99, and then 3 months is $24.99. And of course, a full year is $99 or $69, depending on the package itself. And then you'd have to buy the VR headset and the headphones, you know, especially if you're using a phone and you want to get the full experience. And, you know, we're still pretty early days in the sense that, you know, we're signing a lot of partners, but the content, you know, we're getting new content in every day, but it's not as much content as, you know, we would like to have. But, you know, we're bringing different artists. So for music, we just did a release with Lady Gaga. We've done stuff with Ringo Starr and, you know, Bon Jovi, and the list goes on. So our goal is to continue to grow the platform so that artists themselves are putting the content on there. But, you know, for now, we're doing a lot of specials because we realize that it's not as much content there as there should be. But you have, you know, you can also consume Seek on Oculus. You can consume Seek on HTC. You can consume it in so many different places. And a lot of people now are buying, you know, the Seek tokens because they know that as we grow, then they're going to be able to have that advantage of being able to use it to, you know, consume the content that they want or to even buy the hardware.
Right. To have the most superior experience, would you recommend a VR headset over just a phone? So something like Oculus, if I wanted to set myself up, because, you know, for most people buying an Oculus, if it's just to play a few shoot 'em up games, you know, killing a few zombies, it's quite a big outlay. But if I was buying an Oculus knowing that I was going to be enjoying some live events, you know, several times a month ongoing for years, it suddenly becomes, you know, a very worthwhile purchase. And you know, what you stated in terms of how much the subscription would be was actually way less than I expected it. You know, when you said $9.99, I was figuring, you know, to watch, say, a game might be like $30, $40. But depending upon the experience, like if you're going to watch the Super Bowl and you're going to watch it in style, I mean, $30, $40, right. You know, if you're a fan of that team, I mean, that's pretty much a no-brainer if you can't get to the game. It certainly beats watching it on a regular, you know, HD TV. True. When do you expect the service to kind of launch fully, that so that we could go home now and sign up and start using this thing? When do you kind of think that launch will be for everybody?
Oh, now, I mean, you can get on there now. And, you know, and that's why with the Seek headset, right? This is our own VR headset. It's only $99. Okay. And so it's a great place to start. You know, it's a great place.
I'm sorry, that shocked me because I bought my kid the new Oculus and it was much more expensive than that. Let's just get that out of the way right there. So, I mean, why are you throwing all these bargains at us all of a sudden?
Can you buy those directly from the website, from the Seek?
From Seek.com. Seek.com.
You might notice two new purchases at the end of this. So.
I mean, I was kidding about signing up, but now I'm sitting here
as
like...
As soon as we get off, we're going to be signing up for it.
Right, and check out Lady Gaga, you know, behind the scenes. We did a great behind the scenes with Lady Gaga. So it's $99 for that. So it's a great starting point. You know, when you're not ready to commit fully to getting, you know, that big computer, gaming computer. And then also for a lot of casual gamers, right? So I say for casual gamers that are not ready to, you know, strap all kinds of stuff to their back and mount up, it's great to start, look around, enjoy some concerts, you know, some Bon Jovi, Ringo Starr, you know, Lady Gaga, Ziggy Marley, and then also just even maybe to chill or look at what we're doing with Southampton. So, and you don't have to use it just for our Seek content. When you buy our headset, you can also use it for all the VR content that's out there. So the big difference is, you know, with our app, you could see a whole bunch of stuff. You don't have to download multiple apps just to consume content. But there is a lot that you could do with it.
So I don't know quite how to ask this question, but
I feel something bad coming on.
There's a certain part of society which has been with us since humankind began,
who
tends to drive a lot of the technological advancement, and I'm sure they must be watching this pretty closely, and I'm not talking about the military. Have any of these companies kind of approached you and been like, hey, look, we notice your technology might be good for this other type of experience here? Has there been any interest kind of shown in that? Because it's got to be a no-brainer for some of these companies that this is a whole new channel of distribution where they can really charge top dollar for this type of thing.
Yeah, on a daily basis, we get people asking, is it fog-free, right? And usually when people are asking about whether it's fog-free, we're like, what kind of experience is going to require heavy panting and all that stuff? But, you know, yes, the porn industry is already, you know, using VR.
Right.
And, you know, they're saying that some of the experiences are super, super realistic. So we're seeing that we get strip clubs and all kinds of, you know, uses that you can imagine. I mean, we're personally not distributing any porn on the Seek site.
Sorry but about that, Wolf. Right, okay.
No, I just think it's got to be like, you know, it's going to be a market which is going to be exploited
she already knows how dirty your mind is now.
Right. If you need two people to set up a sub company who can kind of handle that side of the operations,
that could be taken the wrong way.
Yeah, not acting.
So.
The content is out there. You know, you can use a headset to consume it, but we're not creating the content. But there are people creating
it. We weren't volunteering to create the content. So no.
Sometimes I just don't know about you. So as far as somebody like me who has, you know, dropped the money on the Oculus, it still works on all of that. Not to put off your headset, because I really wish I'd have bought yours. It was a lot cheaper than that Oculus. But, you know, for the current technology that's out there, they can The user can download an app and all that right now, right?
Yes. If you're on the Oculus, you can download Seek on Oculus and be able to access all of our content. Yes.
And yeah. What other platforms can you get it on?
So Oculus, on HTC Vive, of course, we're on Android, iOS, and then even, you know, if you're on YouTube 360, you can use our headset to consume the content, but it's not the same quality on YouTube 360, for example, but, you know, the scale and the quality, it's just as awesome, you know, on Oculus as well.
Gotcha. So another one that just kind of popped into my mind because of the Oculus deal. I remember when I got this for my kid, I took it over to my parents' house. My parents are 85 and 80 years old. My dad watched a video on the Oculus. I don't remember what it was. I think it was like mountain climbing or something like that. And even though he was sitting in a chair, you still get that kind of motion feeling, right? Mm-hmm. My mother wouldn't touch it. She gets really bad motion sickness. She gets car sickness. She actually went on a cruise, but I think single-handedly saved the Dramamine company because of all the Dramamine she was taking. So what about those folks with like motion sickness that they kind of get afraid, or the claustrophobia or whatever? What can you tell those folks?
I would love to, you know, send one of our Seek, you know, headsets to your mom to try and see, because the motion sickness comes from the heavy sensors that are in, you know, things like Oculus, you know, because they have the sensors that are embedded into the display and into the equipment itself. For what we're using, this is just a simple mechanical device. So we're using the, you know, it's a mechanical device. You download the app, you put your phone in it, you can adjust the focal, you know, they're all the adjustments that are in there. So your phone, we're using the accelerometer and the gyroscope and all the stuff on your phone itself. So, you know, I would love to, you know, see her feedback after she tries some of the content that's on there. And there's not as much motion that goes on in there also. So the lack of the sensors, the ability to adjust the eye distance and all of these things that we're doing for light VR experience. So, you know, I would love for her to try it and see.
Yeah, that's interesting because, yeah, I mean, she was totally afraid of it.
Right.
You know, because my dad, he's sitting there in a chair and he's like, whoa, you know, and he's doing the moving around thing, and it completely freaked her out. And she said, no, I don't want to try it. I'm afraid of it. And of course, I know, you know, motion sickness. My wife gets it a little bit. She's not a roller coaster rider or whatever. She put the Oculus on. I think it lasted about 10 seconds. And then she took it off too. And she said, you know, she was starting to get a headache and things like that. So,
yes. It's the sensors, the heavy sensors that are acting directly on your senses. And the other thing too is the way men and women process visuals are different. You know, men use what is called motion by, you know, motion parallax, and then women use shape by sharding. And so a lot of the equipment that's out there are not really processing, taking that into consideration, because, you know, they're built by men and not tested on women. And so that's why you find that a lot of women, when they try the equipment, you know, get motion sickness, they get, you know, all kinds of headaches. I was getting that as well in the beginning. And so by not having the sensors in there, by the way we're rendering, taking into account, you know, the ability to render for both. And there are a few things that when we detect, we're able to render the content differently to make for a more comfortable experience. But I would love for them to be able to adjust, you know, the focal distance to something that's comfortable for them, adjust the eye distance to something that's comfortable for them. A lot of the headsets out there too, they don't have the eye distance adjustment. So if you're a woman, which we have different eye distance than men, your eye interpupillary distance is different. So it's pulling your eyeballs apart. So if they can adjust that and the focal distance, not have the sensors, and just even hold it, don't put the straps on, hold it and have them look in there until it's adjusted. And you see that they have a great experience, you know, maybe do something light, like the mind show, you know, and I would be very curious to see the experience that they have with it.
So one other, you know, just kind of personal thing out of me. I think it's in Tennessee. I'm pretty sure in the Smoky Mountains. They have these telescopes, you know, the deals that you reach up and you put your eyes there and you kind of look around. And they created a colorblind version where you can click on there and say, I'm colorblind, and you can actually look at everything out there and see it in real colors for colorblind people. I'm colorblind, so I'm kind of curious, have y'all looked at anything like that to say, hey, let's put a colorblind setting on here so somebody that's colorblind wants to go through this forest or watch a sporting event? Or what was that football game? There was a football game like 2 or 3 years ago where all the colorblind people, myself included, were complaining because the jerseys were so close together for colorblind people, we couldn't tell who was who. But have you ever looked into something like that?
I haven't, but we will. We have
trademark. Trademark.
Right. You
trademark.
Should.
I got
you should.
It.
You should. You should. But I spent a lot of time looking at why VR was so uncomfortable for women, which is actually, you know, something that's very close to my heart, and worked very, very tirelessly, you know, to create a VR headset that's comfortable for everyone in the family, men, women, which is how I discovered the differences between how we render visuals differently. But the colorblind, that's a huge one. You need to own that market.
Well, we're lazy. So I said it, I got excited. And then like 10 minutes later, I'm going to be like, yeah, it seems like a lot of work.
Well, Mary can run with it because she's an entrepreneur. Yeah, she can get a handle on it.
I'll take 0.5%.
Yeah. Right. So, we'll do an NFT. We'll do a smart contract.
There we go. I
actually learned, I think it was about 30 years ago, that the reason why video games are a very slow uptake among females was that the way women process triangles is very different than men. Men will see the triangle, then concentrate on the points that make up the triangle, whereas women see the points of the triangle, then formulate the actual lines of the triangle in their mind before they actually see the triangle. And the way the old gaming systems were developed with polygons, women's brains kind of like put the images together very differently. And so it wasn't quite so immersive for them. It seemed more of a concentrated thing. They couldn't get in it and go through the flow. It had more of a stressful effect than a relaxing effect. And apparently until they switched past, until like consoles had greater power to actually, you know, basically affect each pixel rather than drawing polygons
like
to make
smooth
an image.
It out.
Yeah. That apparently was the big reason why it took a long time for females to get into gaming, because it was more of an uncomfortable experience for them neurologically, just in the way they saw an image and how their brain put that image together. And it did, they put, you know, electrodes all over, you know, various subjects. And women would actually get stressed playing pretty simple games rather than relaxing and playing.
Stressed
it.
Like you get playing Rocket League because you suck.
Oh, I'm brilliant at Rocket League. My girlfriend's terrible at Rocket League.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Yeah, it's the same.
Yes,
yeah.
It's very true. He sucks at Rocket League.
So I've had this running joke for 30 years, which I kind of annoy my girlfriend with by saying, yeah, women can't see triangles.
So that's how's that working for you?
She denies it. Yeah. I've shown her the research. She still doesn't believe me.
Well, Mary, thank you for spending so much time with us today. I mean, this is some fascinating stuff. I mean, it really
thank
is.
You.
And just a little aside, tonight I'm actually going to a concert, a live concert and everything.
Oh, nice.
And going to bring some of this up. I actually know one of the bands that's going to play tonight, so I'm going to, you know, tell them, hey, you guys got to check this out, because they did one of those virtual concerts, you know, and I bought a virtual ticket and sat there in my living room and watched it on TV, but it's no different than, you know, watching any other live performance on a TV versus this more immersive experience. So can you tell everybody how they can get a hold of you, how to find you on social media, website, all this stuff, how to get the cool, much cheaper than an Oculus headset and all that good stuff?
Definitely. So visit seek.com, and it's CEEK.com. So it's seek, not with an S, but with a C. CEEK.com.
Very good.
Cool.
Very good. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm pretty sure after after we get done with this, I think you got two new customers. To be quite honest with you, it's going to be a lot of fun. Going to be a lot of fun, and we certainly appreciate you spending some time with us today and telling us all about Seek. And that will do it for this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd, and we will catch you on the next
one. Thank you, Mary.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.